Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone. Many apologies for not having been able to churn out any shows during the course of the World Cup so far. But as you can imagine, it's been a very busy time for everyone involved in the tournament. But glad to be back, and I'm joined by two individuals who are going to have a little look ahead to the semi-finals this week and pick out some of their main talking points and highlights from the tournament so far. I'm delighted to be joined by friends of the show, Jess Fishlock, Rachel Causey, both obviously members of the Seattle Reign. Guys, how you doing?
Yeah, we're doing really good, thanks.
Marvellous. So, let's look ahead before we look back. We've got two big semi-finals in the Women's World Cup this week. We've got Japan against England and we've got Germany against the United States. Easiest one, I guess, for you guys to start with would be the Germans against the Americans. You both play out in the NWSL. First off, before we go into that game, what's been the kind of reaction over in the States? Lots of media publicity. What's the kind of feeling over there about the team at the moment?
Yeah, you know, I think everybody is excited and also a little bit apprehensive. I think everyone is super excited for the USA. You know, they've got to the semi-finals now and they've won all these games, they're not conceding goals, and you know, that's a positive, but I think people are still a little bit wary of their attack and the balance that they have in the midfield. So it's one of those where it's like, if we get the balance right in midfield, we're fine and we're good to go, but we have the most balanced they've been were their last game against China, I would say, which was their most successful team kind of performance because the balance was right. And I think that was definitely the feeling in America, was that, you know, Morgan Bryan came in and she just gives them a balance to allow Lloyd to do what she wants to do. And I think that's what people feel. So they're really excited because they're hopeful that, you know, each game that goes on, the USA I get them better, and keep progressing.
Rach, I went on a podcast over the weekend to speak about the game, and one of the things I picked up on, and actually Jess has mentioned it, is that Morgan Bryan came in to the side against China, and it allowed that freedom a little bit more for Carly Lloyd to get forward. Is there an argument that not necessarily that Lloyd and Lauren Holiday can't play together, but they don't necessarily get the best out of each other when they're paired together in midfield?
Yeah, I think a lot of people as well have spoken about formations, and I think, well, we've certainly spoken about it here too, and I think we feel that Lloyd and Cheney or Holiday, she is now, are both at their best when they get the chance to be in that 10 role, and they've shown, not just internationally but in the league, how good they are in that position. And unfortunately, because there's a large aspect of their role when they play as a two together to also be defensive minded, then I think it does limit how much they can impact the game in an attacking sense. And I think it was good against China. I don't think it was just down to the combination of midfield. I actually thought that the choice for Rodriguez to play up top with Morgan was effective. I thought they moved well together. And I think that was also a brave choice, because I know from just being around the American fans and the supporters, there's, you know, a lot of people follow Wambach and LaRue, and there's a big push for them to be in the field. But I actually thought that that China game, that Morgan and Rodriguez, their partnership was probably as successful as I've seen in any other games that the US have played in.
So Jess, is the key for Jill Ellis then to try and find a formation that can accommodate Lloyd and Holiday, or in your view, do you think you play one or the other?
I think it's very difficult for Ellis because he has a lot of good big players and has a lot of you know, kind of superstars that are really pushed here to play, and people want them to play, like Rachel said, due to their names or et cetera, et cetera. I think the key for America is that they just have a balance. And when they have a balance, then they get their players to play at the level that we know that they can play at. So I think, yeah, you know, I think the key for them is they do get a holder in there, and that I don't feel is Holiday, and I don't feel it's Lloyd, because they don't, it's not in their nature or their mindset to be overly disciplined, because, you know, they're just so good in the attack. I mean, Cheney is, for me, the best attacking midfielder that there is. and you're kind of making us sit deep, and I don't think that that is good for Holiday, and I don't think it's good for America. So I do feel that, you know, it'll be interesting against Germany, because, you know, they have to find a way to get a three in that middle. Now, your question is, do they go a three with Morgan Brian and Cheney and Lloyd, or do they stick to their two and have whoever's up top drop in? You know, 100% with what Rachel said, it's obviously, you know, what we talk about quite regularly is, if they do go a two and have their two up top, you know, one of them has to be A-Rod, because she will naturally drop in and create a three in the middle, which I don't feel you get if you go Wambach and LaRue or Alex and LaRue, because you don't necessarily get that person who drops straight back in to help out an already ill-disciplined or ill-balanced midfield. So I think that against Germany is key for the USA, and it's Ellis's decision of what is she going to do with her midfield, and how is she going to make sure that Germany do not dominate that area, because if you allow Germany with their players to dominate that area, then you are asking for a lot of trouble for 90 minutes.
Okay, we'll come on to Germany shortly, but Rach, you're a defender playing at centre-back for club and country. Tell me about the importance of that partnership that's developed between Julie Johnston and Becky Sauber. And I've said on numerous podcasts that I've appeared on and articles that I've been able to write that, for me, Julie Johnston has been the star of this US team. She's stepped into big shoes in the shape of Christy Rampone. She's not been in the side all that long. She was only announced as a starter just before the tournament began, but she has taken her chance and some, and really developed a good relationship with Becky Sauber, hasn't she? But from a defender's perspective like yourself, how impressive have they been?
Yeah, they've been very good together. You know, I think as well, Hope's not had an awful lot to do, and it's largely been because of that backline discipline. I think both Sauber and Johnston, I think they have a good balance between them. I think probably we've mentioned Johnston a little bit more than Sauber because she's made some good last-ditch tackles. But I think Sauber really has been probably the key to making sure that they've been so compact, and probably does a lot more of the organisation side of things. And yeah, they've both been impressive, and as has the whole back four, I guess, from a defensive point of view. Klingenberg's done well, and so has Krieger defensively. So, yeah, they have a strong unit, and I think if we are realistic, though, the biggest challenge will be Germany, and I don't think that, if we're being truly honest, we would have expected the games that they've played in so far in the knockout stages with China and Colombia, we would have expected them to have done as well as they have, so it'll be interesting to see now how they do against Germany, because that really will test, I'm sure, both of them, and will test everybody defensively.
Well, it's an opportunity to speak to you, Jess, about Germany, especially because you spent part of your season last year with Frankfurt, who obviously went on to win the UEFA Women's Champions League just after you returned to America. Tell me about some of the stand-up players for you that are in that team, because they have a huge attacking threat. And as Rachel said, USA haven't been hugely tested since probably the group games. Colombia and China, they were expected to win, and they won comfortably. This is a step up, and a big step up for them. So what are the main things that you think are going to be the threats in the German side?
I think, to be honest, the press. I think the press that the Germans put on is just fantastic. When they get their press right, and they go at the pace and the tempo that they do, you know, I think the USA might struggle with that, because I don't necessarily think that they've been put under an awful lot of pressure at the back. And like I said, you know, with the way that they do press, and it, Mittag actually have scored a couple of goals through this, is that they win it high, and Hurd and Sausage link up, and, you know, nine times out of ten, they either get a goal-scoring opportunity or they score. And then that comes to my point again about the midfield in the USA teams. The USA team midfield has to be able to get the ball under pressure in the midfield, but be okay with that. And I think so far you've seen that they've actually lost the ball, and there's been a lot of turnovers from pressure in the midfield already from the USA, and that's against teams that probably don't actually even put them under a great deal of pressure. So I think that's going to be one of the Germans' one of their weapons that they, I think, will use, because when they do press, and I mean, they've got Lauda, who is so fast and so clever, and from a 1v1 point of view, I think she is so good at either going line or cutting inside and then creating an overload. And then with that, you know, you have Gosling and Leopolds, who will probably be playing with Mittag and Sausage and Pop. Between all of them, just individually, you want to go, you know, if a team had one of those in their team, you'll be going, well, we want to try and stop them getting the ball. But the Germans are going to have three great players kind of in that middle, with then Simon and Pop on the outside, who are not really outside players, so they kind of play with overloading areas. So, you know, I just think it's going to be, like you say, it's going to be a huge test for the USA. More so, I feel, out of possession than in possession. And I think that's going to be key. If they can really limit Germany to chances and to possession and to really not allowing them a lot of space and freedom to play in, then, you know, I think USA will cause their own problems. But, you know, I've played, like you said, with a lot of these German girls, and individually they're brilliant, but as a unit they are... They have shown this World Cup too, that they don't even have to play well and they'll still get results.
Rachel, I'll come to you in a sec. Jess, very quickly, you played for Frankfurt with Jennifer Marajan last season. We haven't seen an awful lot of her. Have you been surprised by that?
Yes and no. I think, like you say, you know, the Germans play a 4-4-2 and go with one of their strikers that drops in, you could say, and helps out when they press. And with Marajan, I feel that, you know, if you're going to play Gosling and Marajan together, you are really kind of a similar situation to Holiday and Lloyd, where her and Gosling kind of like to get forward. They like to be playmakers. They like to try and score some goals. They're quite similar players. Which is why you'll see that Sylvia Nate tries, whenever she's playing and she wants to be compact and she wants to really, you know, dominate that midfield, she tends to go with Leopolds and then Gosling and then brings in Marajan, because she gets the stability from Leopolds, because she kind of just sits there. She sits there and then lets Gosling, Mittag, Simon just play. I think when you saw Gosling and Marajan together, you don't really see them on the ball that much because they both kind of want to do the same thing. So it surprised me because of how good she is. But this is her first World Cup. I think people forget how young she is. And so I'm assuming that Germany are just doing what Germany do. And, you know, they don't force players to come in and play. They just allow them to do what they want to do and make sure that they get the experience and not put too much pressure on them. But then on the flip side, you've got to remember that they had their four PKs, and, you know, even though Marajan was injured, they still want to do it on that ball. So that just shows how much quality they know that she has and how high she does sit in their minds.
Rach, were you surprised by how, I'm going to be honest, underwhelming Germany were against France and how much they were outplayed? And if we're being brutally honest, the French probably should have gone through had Gaetantine not missed that chance right at the end of extra time, because they were outplayed, weren't they? For a team that's ranked number one in the world, we're expecting it to be, in terms of performance, a lot closer than it was. And it was only because of France's poor finishing and other aspects, a poor penalty decision that went against them, that it's not them coming up against the USA. Did that surprise you in any way?
No, not really. I think there's not a great deal between I would say probably the top three or four teams in the world, and sometimes ranking doesn't tell the whole story. And I think France have been building and building for a number of years now, and they've got a lot of really, really good players in there, and they also play in a style that suits the players that they have. And I always felt that with their 4-3-3 that that it was going to be difficult in the midfield for Germany, and I think it was, but also I think it was actually a really open game and it was really enjoyable to watch. And me personally, I don't necessarily think the penalty decisions were wrong. I didn't think that the Mittag one was a penalty, and I felt that the one that Germany did get was probably more so. And I know you do see them given and you don't, but it's just the luck of the draw at the end of the day and the referee that you get and how she views it. But I thought it was actually, the game was just very open and played at fantastic speed and level, and players wanted to play, and I thought it was actually great to watch. And I thought it, yeah, perhaps France should have edged it, and obviously they missed that good chance at the end, but I just thought it was two great teams on a great occasion playing great football, and I thought it was a good advertisement for the women's game, really.
What was your reaction when you saw the ball go to Gaetantine at the back post and she puts it wide?
Similar to yours, I probably would have put my mortgage on it. So I was hugely surprised that she missed it, but it was just one of those things, and I'm sure she'll remember that for a long time. But sadly, that's just part of the game. These chances come and they go, and you just have to get on. And she's probably, I was surprised she didn't start in that game, actually, because I think she's probably one of France's best players, if not their best player, in my opinion. I was surprised she missed it, because she's very, very good.
Probably one for both of you, and by all means, you can both answer, or one of you can answer. Claire Lavoisier was the player that missed the decisive spot kick. You know, in her first World Cup, 20, 21 years old, been given the responsibility of what was the decisive spot kick to take it into sudden death. I was admittedly quite critical of that, because for me, you should have your more experienced players putting themselves forward in those sort of situations. By all means, get her a penalty kick, but maybe take one of the earlier ones. A few people sort of said, well, if she's offered to put her hand up, then you have to trust her. But I wondered what your views were on that, because for me, I want my experienced players. I'm overwhelmed, and I'm glad that she's put her hand up to take a spot kick, but I wouldn't necessarily have put her on the fifth one.
Yeah, I've kind of already voiced my opinion on this, and I'll say this. Who was Germany's last penalty taker? Sasic. And she was the last penalty taker because she is arguably, and she is their penalty taker, because they know that under that amount of pressure, you need someone who it just will not affect. And I actually said on Twitter, I was like, you don't put this kid in someone's gun. She's not a kid. And I'm like, well, she is a kid, because actually the way that it works now is you have your U20s and your U23s, and you don't really go nowadays straight into your national team. Like back in the day when we were younger, then yeah, you know, it might have, because there was just not enough players. But nowadays you go through, you know, the youth levels. And she's a very good player, and obviously France view her very highly, and she's going to be a huge player for them in the future. I don't doubt that. But I just don't think, and I think anyone who knows, you know, at the elite level and at that point, you know, she might think that she's okay to go and take this penalty. And you know, like you say, you can't fault that. But she might think that she's okay. But no, she won't know what it's like going up to take that penalty, knowing that the nine in front of you have just taken perfect penalties, and the fate of everything is on it. She would never have felt anything like that in her entire career. So, no, my answer is you don't put that on somebody who is just gaining experience and learning their role in the team, to be honest, because that's what she's doing right now, is learning and understanding her role in this French team and developing with the French. And you know, I just don't think that with the likes, when you have Abeli and the Seep and Tinny and Renard and Henry, you don't say, okay, you take all these, but let this girl take the last one. You go, okay, you want to take one, that's fine, but you don't take the last one. You don't take the last one. You let Abeli take that one, or you let Nasip take that one, because they've been at this place before. They had penalties against England and knocked them out last time in the World Cup at this stage. And I stand by that. When England went out, Rafferty took that penalty and Faye White took the penalties. But I'm saying, you know, learn from that. Learn from Claire Rafferty being the first World Cup that she's in, comes on late as a sub, drags her penalty wide. Like, France should have learned something from that, because it's arguably the same situation.
Yep, couldn't agree more. And I voiced that. Rach, you got any views?
I can understand that opinion, but I also slightly differ. I mean, obviously she, well, we don't know. Maybe she did say she wanted one, or maybe their coach just said, this is who's taken and this is the order. I don't know if they practiced or not, but I think, you know, no matter who it is, there was 9 out of 9 penalties were scored before that. I mean, that's immense pressure. And I think no matter who you are on that stage, even if you've taken 10 penalties before that in a similar environment, which I doubt anyone has, but even if you had, I still think that's an extremely nervous and tough position to be in. So for anyone, really, it's always a difficult penalty to take. And I think, obviously, she's a confident player. She's obviously in a good place. She is brave enough to step up and take it. And I think, at the end of the day, whoever misses in penalty shootouts, it's always a shame for. And I think there's also an argument in the fact that you can have your best penalty taker as your fifth penalty in and not get to them. And then people criticise that too. People go, well, why would you have your best penalty taken last and we didn't get to her? You know, so I've seen that as well. So I think you have your penalty takers, they take them, and it's harsh on the people that miss, and it's obviously great for the team that wins. So I don't really have an opinion on whether she should have been last or first. I think it is what it is.
Okay. Good stuff. Well, I guess the best thing for me to do before we move on to the other semi-final between Japan and England is to try and get a prediction from you guys. So Jess, who's going through, USA or Germany?
Oh, Katie, you're killing me.
I had to give a prediction on another show that I went on, so if I'm going to be put in that position, I'm putting other people in it as well.
My heart says USA, but my head says Germany.
Rach?
I have to go with Germany as well. I think as much as I would love to see USA in the final, I just think it's going to be tough against the Germans in what we've seen so far from both teams.
Okay, great stuff. Well, before we move on to our other semi-final, I managed to catch up very quickly with our friends out in France, Futsdel, to get their views on the quarter-final against Germany and the French tournament in general. So here they are giving us a brief update from over in France.
Hello, Kieran. Let's talk about the French team and its performance during the World Cup. Isn't it sad that France lost the quarterfinals? Of course it is, and even more so when we're able to witness such a beautiful brand of football, probably the best in the tournament yet. How many times has Germany been woman-handled and dominated like this? Not many. So there are good lessons to learn from the tournament, but the facts are simple. France lost the quarterfinals way too soon from what everyone expected, after a game that once again they should have won, like in 2013 or in 2012 for the most recent tournaments. Yes, it was against Germany, the best team in the FIFA classification, but the classification doesn't really matter when you dominate a game like this. For the big picture, France won but didn't play great against England in its opening game, then lost to Colombia, one of the biggest surprises of the tournament, before winning largely against Mexico and South Korea, who was playing without its best player. All in all, France had two great games and displayed a beautiful brand of football, but lost in the third one. That isn't that impressive for a team that was among the favourites of the tournament. It doesn't make watching the sadness of the players easier, though, especially the young Claire Lavoisier, who showed how great she will be in the future. Now, once again, France will try to win the title next year at the Olympic Games after a big disillusion, probably with the same players for the last time. By the way, thank you, England, for allowing us to be qualified for Rio even before playing the quarterfinals. Speaking about other teams, Sweden went out early, as we pretty much expected. things need to change because there are some really great, great players in their team, some of them in the French D1. By Canada, by Christine Sinclair, by Diana Matheson, by Christina Leblanc, and the others. It is always tough watching the home team being eliminated quite early, even more when such great players are saying bye-bye to the World Cup, or even to their career. Congratulations to Cameroon, China, and Australia, three young teams that will be very dangerous in the near future. Congratulations also to England for their qualification to the semis, and no surprise, congratulations to the three best teams in the world, Germany, the USA, and Japan. Great games are coming towards us until the end of the tournament. Until next time.
You're listening to Women's Soccer Zone. Follow us on Twitter during the World Cup on @WOSOZone.
So that was our friends Fuchsdale out in France giving us their views on the French World Cup. From a personal perspective, a little bit disappointing that they weren't able to come through against Germany. Thought they were excellent throughout the tournament, especially Amadou and Henri, who really drove that team from midfield. But we move on to the second semi-final, which is between England and Japan. We got it sort of a little bit the wrong way around in the first semi, where we maybe previewed the game before we looked at the quarterfinals. So let's start with those quarterfinals. First off, it was Japan against Australia. You both saw the game. Jess, you've played out in Australia, so you will know many of the girls that were involved in that match. Australia were impressive throughout the tournament, weren't they? But probably just ran out of legs in that game against Japan.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I think happened, to be honest. I mean, if you look at Australia's run-in, I mean, I don't think any team had it any more difficult than Australia. They were in the group of death, played extremely well in the group of death, and then had Brazil, and then had Japan. I mean, that's a pretty rough, I think, between them and Germany, they had a difficult route. And, you know, I think their win against Brazil was huge and just showed, you know, just how good of a team that they can be. But I think Japan then, you know, I think with the heat was a huge factor with Australia, because I feel, you know, their game relies on so much of high intensity and explosive power and running that you compare that to the way that Japan play, and I don't think the heat really would have altered the way that the Japanese play. It really doesn't matter to them, because, you know, they don't tend to make, you know, big, huge counterattacks or high intensity running so much. They just play in such a nice way. And I think I felt a little bit bad for Australia, because I feel that if the heat wasn't what it was, then it might have been a different game. But you know, I think they can definitely go home and be proud and now keep building. But I think with Japan, they're just getting better and better with each game now, you know. I think they kind of just coasted through the group stages. I don't really think they were too bothered about that. But now in the knockout stages, they're getting better and better.
Rach, Japan, arguably the best team in the world at keeping the ball. If you don't keep the ball yourselves, you're going to be chasing shadows for most of the game. How difficult is it as an opposition player to play against the Japanese, or a team like the Japanese, when they have so much of the ball and sometimes you may have only 30-40% possession during a 90-minute match?
Yeah, well, it obviously gets extremely tiring, and I think that was highlighted in the Australia game, because I think they did well to minimise the clear-cut chances for a lot of the game, but obviously the last 15 minutes it started to open up, and I think we saw Japan miss a couple of pretty clear-cut chances before they did eventually get that goal. And I think that's ultimately what happens against these teams. They just wear you down, and when you don't see the ball for such long spells, it becomes extremely difficult to stay concentrated and to keep working at the intensity that you're trying to work at. And you can see how fatigued the Australians were, and I think it's a tactic that Japan have obviously used to their strength and have worked on for a number of years, and it was obviously extremely successful at the last World Cup and in the Asian Cup since then. And like you say, they're arguably the best team in the world at keeping the ball, and they're great to watch, and it's a learning curve probably for a lot of teams on how to move and possess the ball. And it's, like I say, probably one of the best games we have seen was the game against Australia, and really enjoyed watching it. And it was a shame for the Australians that they went out with such a late goal.
Jess, you had Naomi Kawasumi at Seattle last year, so you will have seen close up what it's like to play and train with one of the Japanese squad members. Why is it they are so different? Because they are a team that keep the ball so well. They haven't really changed their style from 4 years ago when they won the World Cup. Why are there not more teams trying to, not necessarily copy that style, but try and get to that level of possession football and really try and almost outplay the opposition in a way that they do?
I think because you have to be extremely technical and very, very smart. And it's very rare that you would get 11 players who are very technical, extremely smart, and understand exactly what, when to pass the ball, what foot to pass the ball to. You know, I bet you anyway that they do talk, you can hear that they talk, but I bet you at the same time, you know, even if you banned communication, they would still know exactly what's going on. You know, they just view that way, and they're just brought up that way, that that's just how they learn. It's their culture, and it's a mentality. And one of the hardest things to do or to change at any point is a mentality, because it just becomes your default. And the way that Japan are and why they play such beautiful football is because it is even their default. You know, at times, you know, you still can get frustrated with Japan and you're like, oh, you know, why haven't you gone forward here, or why haven't you gone forward here? And then, I mean, and then 10 passes later, they're exactly where they were, only under much more control. And the team who they're playing against are like pinned back in their area, and you're like, ah, okay, so that's why you didn't go forward now. Now you just made 10 passes to get there, but the opposition team are just completely lost. So it's an art, I think. And like when Naho was playing with us, you know, you would just be amazed and just be in awe, really, at the way that she views the game and conducts herself and moves. You know, they don't do anything out of the ordinary or anything extreme, the Japanese. And that's what I find so beautiful, is they don't do anything crazy. They just do the very simple things, but they do them extremely well.
Rach, before we move on to Canada against England, just how good were Australia in this tournament? As Jess mentioned, group of death. Late goal going out to Japan had arguably, well, not arguably, they did have the most difficult run throughout the World Cup, but they won a lot of fans, didn't they? And still a very young team when you look at some of the star players in that side. They've got a big future, and again, they should be a team to look out for in 2019, shouldn't they?
Yeah, they should be. They've, like you say, they have some young players, and now they have some young players who are gaining valuable experience, and would have been interesting, perhaps, should they have been in a different side of the draw where they might not have had such tough opposition. But yeah, they showed that they could play with the best and against the best. And I think, you know, that result against Brazil really shows the quality they have. But when you have to play so many tough games one after the other, it was always going to tire them out and be difficult for them to keep on getting through. But yeah, they did very well, and they'll be a team definitely to look out for in the next couple of years.
Okay. So the final quarterfinal was England against Canada, who played on Saturday night, early hours of Sunday morning over here in the UK. It was a game that even before it had kicked off, there were some major talking points. There was some nice war of words between John Herdman and Mark Sampson. Nothing particularly controversial, but it was nice to see a little bit of bite and a little bit of spice before the game. But also two talking points for me, especially one on either side. The first one was alleged comments that Carmelina Moscato had made earlier in the week about unrest within the Canadian camp that she'd allegedly made to former teammate Christine Latham, who now works for the Fox Soccer. And secondly, on the England side, was a tweet that went out from Jordan Nobbs literally 2 hours before kickoff that stated she was out of the World Cup in a post that she'd put up on her blog site Kicker, which was then removed And when Mark Sampson was asked about Jordan Nobbs' availability before the game, he said it was news to him and that she was a sub and was available to come on. Now, I'm also told from a member of the media that was at that game that Jordan didn't warm up with the subs before the match. So take that how you will. But I guess I'm not going to ask you to comment on Moscato's comments or alleged comments, guys, because I don't want to get you into trouble. However, what I'd like to know is if you've got a player in your team that has allegedly made comments about unrest, whether there is or not, and then it's made public, how disruptive is that to a camp before a quarter final of a major tournament?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that affects. I think it does affect. I do. I think that it either goes one way or the other. Either calm, gets kind of ostracized and isolated, and, you know, she gets blamed and she's a scapegoat because everyone thinks she's away, you know, bad mouthing the team because she's not really had a lot of minutes, which I don't necessarily. I mean, what I think about that is neither here nor there. Or the camp. It's a lie and the camp is fine and everyone just laughs it off. I mean, it could literally go either way. But I think the way that the Canadians work, the way that they are so intense about everything, especially that camp, especially that group of players with the fact that the World Cup was home, I can't help but think that it might have had an impact on their camp and their spirit. And I think that it would have been talked about. It would have been talked about within the camp that this has been said and this has been said and can you believe it and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Because I don't think that group of players, the way that they are, the way that John Herdman kind of works with them and manages them, I don't think they are able to just wash it aside. Because I don't think that that is the way that their camp works. So, yeah, I think that it was terrible timing. I question, actually, Christine Latham in the fact that she is Canadian and the fact that she should want her team to do extremely well. I question why she feels the need to come out and say that when their team are just about to go into the quarterfinal. I mean, and I think, you know, questions should be asked about that agenda. But yeah, I think it does. I think, like I said, given Canada's camp and the way that they work, I think that isn't something that they just let go and let it go over their heads.
Okay. Rach, maybe you want to pick up on the Jordan Nobbs tweet that was put up about her being out of the World Cup because of a hamstring injury and then being removed. And when Mark Sampson was questioned about it on UK television before the game, he said it was news to him and that she was available, and that despite the fact that she didn't warm up with the subs before. That's an odd situation to be in 2.5 hours before kickoff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not ideal that that came out. I think it's probably a good thing for England that it's just been swept under the carpet and it's kind of been ignored. Like you say, who knows if it was posted accidentally or if someone else has hacked in or whatever, but yeah, I'm glad it's kind of not being dwelt on too much because that wouldn't have been an ideal thing for England and it would have been a distraction, especially with Jordan being the vice-captain and supposedly a big player for their team. It wouldn't have looked good on her and I can imagine it would have caused certainly a distraction to the focus. But, you know, obviously England got a good result and now they can move on and just leave that behind and whatever's happened, hopefully everybody involved learns from that situation.
Agreed. Odd situation, but with England winning the game, I think it has been brushed under the carpet. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no more reason to discuss it. So let's actually look at the positives. Let's talk about the game. I guess from a personal perspective, I tweeted out earlier on in the day that the important thing for England was to get a quick start and get an early goal to silence the crowd. They didn't just manage one, they got two. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but the best possible start for England, almost in dreamland.
Yeah, it was. I think when you go up against a team like Canada and you're able to take the lead like that, you know, given with the other games that they've played, they've struggled to score goals in open play. So I think when you take that two-goal lead, and also in the style that England have played their other games where they've been very compact, very defensive, very organised, they probably felt themselves that they'd given themselves a strong foothold in the match and would probably back themselves to be able to keep a hold of that lead as well. I think the previous games against Canada, England had won also. So I think they definitely had the upper hand in that match. The two-goal cushion gave them a good sort of foothold in the match. And, you know, they gave themselves a little bit of a tricky time with the goal that KB let in just before half-time. But on the whole, it was comfortable for them.
Jess, we were discussing off recording just before we came onto the show about Mark Sampson and how much credit he should take. I've said on another podcast, and I made it quite clear in people that I spoke to in the media when I was out in Canada, I wasn't overwhelmed with his team selection against France. I think he paid too much respect, especially by playing two left backs on the left hand side. But since then, he's learned, hasn't he? And he's picked teams that have done well against the opposition that they've come up against. And I think I predicted 10 of the 11 players that he picked against Canada. I think I got Tony Duggan instead of Jade Moore, but absolutely right to play Jade Moore and Katie Chapman against a team that he had described as very physical in the tournament, because Jade and Katie completely nullified the threat of Desiree Scott and Sophie Schmidt. But he deserves a lot of credit for how he's handled this tournament in his first major competition, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he does. I actually think that I always said that I think that Canada-England game will come down to Herdman and Sampson. As in, tactically and the player selection, that will determine the game, because I don't think there's a lot between Canada and England. I don't think that either play, you know, you couldn't say exactly their style of play, you know. I don't think you can break down, you know, you look at France, you say they possess the ball, you look at Germany, you know what they're going to do. I don't think you can actually particularly say that about England or about Canada. I think they're very, just teams that are very similar, you know, and I think that's the way the game was always going to go. I think it was always going to come down to those two and who gets it right and who gets it wrong. And I think, you know, Mark Sampson got it right and John Herdman got it wrong, and that's the way that the game went, because, you know, it was always going to be, I feel, a game of mistakes rather than a game of fantastic football. And, you know, I have nothing but a huge respect for Sampson and for England, because they are resilient and they have had their luck and they have got through and they're in the semi-final now. And there is something, you know, you have to respect that. And I agree with you. I think Mark, I think, got it wrong against France. I think, you know, given the fact that the game really didn't mean an awful lot, that he came out and he played the way that they did, and, you know, it wasn't great. But since then, I think he's got it spot on. And, you know, they have rode their luck sometimes, but, you know, you have to have that. You know, you don't win tournaments without luck. You need the luck, and I think England have got that, and they have. You know, he gets the tactics right, and they are resilient. And then on top of that, they are scoring some very important goals when they get their chances, and that's all you need to do.
Yeah, Jodie Taylor obviously getting the first goal, and I'll speak about that one in a minute. But Rach, you're lining up for a free kick in your own box. You're defending a free kick coming in from Farrah Williams, and you see on the back post that Lucy Bronze is being marked by Alyssa Chapman, who's 5 foot nothing. What's your reaction as a defender? What are you trying to do to make sure that doesn't become a problem? Because it did become a problem, and that was what resulted in England's second goal.
Yeah, it seemed very unusual that Canada would have allowed that setup. One of the things from playing against Canada is they're extremely organised and normally very good on set pieces. It's actually normally one of their threats. So I was surprised that situation arose. I don't think necessarily the fact that Chapman was marking Bronze was the issue. I think it was the fact that she was so isolated was the biggest problem. However, the header from Bronze, I think probably Erin McLeod, looking back in that, should perhaps do a little bit better. I mean, it's still a little way out, and the ball spent a lot of time in the air before it reaches the goal. So I think, you know, perhaps Canada should be looking at their goalkeeper there to get a hand on it. I have heard numerous times in commentary over here that she's arguably considered to be one of the best goalkeepers in the world, and I don't think she perhaps displayed that in that game against England.
Okay. Well, I mentioned the first goal from Jodie Taylor, who for me has been impressive in the World Cup when she's been given the opportunity. Obviously, she's overcome a knee injury and required surgery only weeks before the tournament. She capitalised on an error by Lauren Sesselman. Now, it's widely agreed that Lauren hasn't had her best tournament and we've not seen the best of her. But the criticism and threats that apparently have been made and the criticism that I've seen on social media has been disgusting. This is a player who came back from a serious ACL injury, worked hard. I interviewed her just before the tournament. She's worked her socks off to get back for this competition. John Herdman is the coach who picks the players and picks the team, and he is the one that's put her in that position. Now, we saw very early on, I think it was maybe even in the first game, where there were a few stray passes from Lauren. And for me, if you can see in the first game that a player is not right or is maybe not playing at the performance rate that we expect of her, then you have to try and change it. Now, for me, it's difficult to kind of comment because I'm not a player. I'm a media man, and you guys are the ones on the pitch. But I was just interested to gain your views on that because, as I say, media are entitled and fans are entitled to make their points and their criticisms. But actually, I think on this occasion, it's a little bit unfair.
Yeah, I would agree. I've not seen so many of the threats or the things that have been said, but I'm aware that they have been going around. And obviously, this, if I put myself in Lauren's shoes, then I don't think I would like it. And like you say, it's not her fault that she was selected. I did see the first game she played in, and she probably didn't have her best game, but I think that's understandable given where she's come from and the pressure she's probably put on herself to get herself back fit and the surroundings, the World Cup being in Canada, etc., etc. So, you know, you can put the first game down to nerves. Herdman obviously feels that she was the best selection for that game. I think, you know, after that, I don't think she actually did too badly for the remainder of the game. And it's just the position that she plays when you make a mistake like that, it leads to goal and that puts you under the direct criticism, and that probably hasn't helped her cause. I think, you know, if it is true that people have sent threats, then I think that's terrible and it's never acceptable, or there's never an appropriate time for that to be said. So I'm appalled that that's the case. And yeah, it's a shame that she's had such criticism because I don't think it's wholly her fault.
And I think, I don't know about you, Jess, but Canada quarterfinals is nothing to sniff at. Yes, as host nation, they would have been expected and hoped that they would have got further, but they didn't score many goals throughout the tournament either. There was a lot of pressure and a lot of focus on Christine Sinclair. And if she was nullified by an opposition defender, or if she was in a position where she was having a quiet game, there wasn't a huge amount around her that was creating problems for opposition players. So you can criticise one player all you like for making an individual error, but actually there's 11 players on that field that were unable to beat England.
Yeah, and I think, you know, actually, I actually think I was watching the game and I was actually really surprised at how Canada were able to actually pass it around or through England, but then they just have nothing in the final third, like nothing. So, and that's why I was, you know, I watched the game and obviously England got two great goals, and I don't know whether that changed the way then that they were going to approach the game, because I don't feel they put Canada under a great deal of pressure. But I then also don't think that Canada put England under a great deal of pressure, and this is what I meant by I don't, they're very, 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 very similar teams, and they play a very, very similar way. I think, you know, when you look at the goals from England, a giveaway and a set play, nothing from open play. And so, you know, I think that's just the way that the game was. And I feel that from minute one, when Canada opened the game, opened the World Cup against China, I think it was, you could see then that they were going to struggle. They were going to struggle to create anything, because it just, you know, the way that John Herdman had set them up and how structured they were, you know, they're just a very predictable team. And, you know, they rely an awful lot on being fit and being able to run, which is great. But if you haven't got the ball and if you don't do anything with the ball, being able to run doesn't really help you that much. So, you know, I wasn't surprised by England beating Canada at all. I thought that it was a very nice run for them, a very nice game for them to play in the quarters. I actually think I did some work for the women's game at the beginning, and I said, you know, England actually have a very nice run to the semi-final. Because if you compare their run to Australia's or to Germany's, I mean, I bet you each of those would have traded everything that they had to have had that type of run in. But, you know, like I said, I don't think that Canada had enough to really get realistically any further than the quarterfinals. And I think, you know, going like you said to Stessman, I think John Herdman, as much as the Canadians love him, I think he has to go and take some responsibility and you know, I think he really, really has a bit to blame, because I don't think he played Sesselman for the right reasons. And I agree, I think it's disgusting what people are saying about Sesselman, and I do feel extremely sorry for her. But it got to the point, I think, during every game, it got to the point where I was like, you are setting this girl up for a fall because she is just not ready. And you could see that when we played against the Swiss, perhaps. It was one of the games. He ended up taking Sesselman off after like 50 minutes and putting Calm in for not anything other than a change that she just wasn't playing well. And you don't tend to do that when it comes to your centre-backs. You know, you tend to, they're your centre-backs and that's it. So I think there's a part of him that knew that. So whether he just felt that Canada didn't have any other options, I don't know. But I certainly think he has more responsibility to take, and not Sesselman. And like you say, I do feel sorry for her, because she had a long, long road to come back to even get to this World Cup, and I think people are forgetting that.
Agreed, completely. I think Canada did as well as they could have. I think quarterfinals was about par for them. Yes, they're the host nation, but that doesn't necessarily always mean that you're going to go right through to the final of the tournament. I think they played brilliantly as hosts. I was out there for a week, and the people have been friendly, the fans have been brilliant, but it was just a shame that they let themselves down a little bit with some of the reaction over Lauren Sesselman, and I think some other players didn't really step up to the plate. I'm not going to name names because I'm not here to join the scapegoat club that has already emerged, but we look ahead to the semi-final. Obviously, it's going to be England against Japan. I guess, very quickly, I'd ask you guys how you feel that game's going to go and who you think the key players are going to be. Start with you, Jess.
I think for England, one of their key players is going to be Jodie Taylor. I think she has done nothing but be brilliant since she has come on and played her position. And I think she's the perfect player to really put Japan under pressure with the way that Japan play. Other than that, I think it's going to be a great game. I think that there's a part of me that thinks that England will win. I think they will be able to perhaps deal with Canada and then get them on the break in Jodie Taylor, because I feel that was what Australia were missing. But at the same time, I look at Japan play and I'm like, I don't want you to not be in the final, because I absolutely agree with everything that you do when it comes to football. So it's interesting, I think. And Japan are just getting better and better, so it's going to be a very good match. Equally, I can't call it like I can't call the other one, but I think my heart says Japan, but I think my head says England.
Rach, we commented earlier about how Mark Sampson has learned from game to game and picked a team that's going to be best equipped to deal with the opposition. What's your view on the players that he might pick for the Japan game? I mentioned how he brought in Jade Moore and Katie Chapman to try and nullify that Canadian midfield with you know, matching them in terms of their strength and their physical attributes. We know that Japan are a team that like to keep the ball and knock it about. Do England then therefore keep players like Jade Moore and Katie Chapman who are going to try and chase after it and win those battles, or do they have to try and bring in ball-playing midfielders who maybe can help England keep the ball better than they did against Canada?
It'll be tricky. I'm not sure the best way to combat Japan. I'm not sure anyone's sure of that. But I think if you play, I think you certainly need some ball players on the pitch that can be mobile enough to work with the movement that Japan will have, but also be able to have the calmness to keep the ball. I think Jade Moore is not someone that's perhaps as big a name as some of the others, but she's certainly capable of keeping the ball as well as making a tackle. And I think Jodie Taylor, again, like Jeff said, is someone who'll have a huge part to play if she does end up playing in the nine. She'll have to do well to hold the ball up, which I think is what they need, and I think she does that better than Aluko. And also she gives you that pace to go in behind again, which we know the Japanese aren't necessarily as fast, or certainly not as fast as Taylor is. So that's another option I think could work well, but I think it will be tough for them, and I probably disagree with Jess. I can't really see anything other than a Japan win at the moment.
We mentioned some of the changes that Mark has made over the course of the tournament. We haven't seen much of any Aluko and Alex Scott, who are players who've been ever-present over the course of qualifying, big personalities, important players in the past. Is this a sign, do you think, Jess, that this England team is evolving a bit and is changing?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in the likes of Lucy Bronze, you have a player who you will invest in and you should invest in. I think she's a huge future for England. And, you know, like I said with Jodie Taylor, it's been a long time coming. I think Hope Powell will look at the way that Mark has brought in some of these players and probably question why she didn't look at the pool of players that she had and why she kept the certain people that she kept for as long as she did, you know. And I think that's what's been refreshing for England, and has been a credit to Mark, is that he has played the teams that has given the balance that he wants, regardless of who they are and what their name is. And I think that has proven to be the most successful thing, sorry about that, of this whole tournament. You know, before now, people, you know, might not have known Lucy Bronze or, like Rachel said, Jade or Chapman even, you know, or Jodie, you know, a lot of these players didn't play for Hope. And I think you can see that what Mark has done is he's actually looked at his pool of players and gone, they can do a job for me that I will need to do dependent on who I play against. And I think, you know, you have to give him nothing but the utmost of respect for doing that, because let me tell you, playing Lucy Bronze and not playing Alex Scott is not an easy decision to make to a nation who has always known Alex Scott as a big personality and a big, you know, big influence on a squad, and the same with Eni Aluko. Yet he has done it, and he has put his trust and his belief in his young players and in these players that people don't know that much about, because he believes in them. And I think that is something, and when I played under Mark, that is something that he did very well. And it's no surprise to me that he's doing that again.
Brilliant. Well, I think that's enough to talk about the two semi-finals happening this Tuesday and Wednesday. Sure to be cracking games. Guys, I guess I'd finish off just a couple of quick questions. I guess, what's been your highlight of the tournament up to this point? Start with you, Rach.
think I'm going to see the France-Germany game. I think that was, from a viewer's perspective and for a football fan, I think that was one of the best games of football I've watched for a long time. It was thoroughly enjoyable. Both teams wanted to win. Both teams had a great style of play. And obviously being a neutral, penalties was fun to watch to finish.
Jess?
Japan's goal. Remember that goal? A little 1-2, little dummy. Who was Holland. It against?
Holland.
Against Holland. Oh. Oh, honestly, I keep watching it and I'm like, oh, God, just stop. Just stop. That, for me, was a highlight because it just summed up not only Japan, but the way that I think the football is and should be played. It was just beautiful. And you know what? Actually, that game itself, for me, was one of the games of the tournament because Japan played great, but you know what? Holland played very well too. And I think they will go home and go, if we were playing anybody else, then perhaps we would have actually gone through ourselves because they played some great football too. So that was one of the games for me, Joe.
I'm not going to ask who your standout player has been. I'm going to word it a little bit differently. If you could pick one player that stood out for you at the World Cup that could make the Seattle Reign a better team, who'd you pick?
Ooh.
That's a tough one.
That is a tough one.
I think, for me, one of the best players so far has been Anya Mittag. I think I've played against her as well. She's probably one of the toughest players I've ever played against, so not necessarily saying that I would take her over Kim, but I think she's a very, very good player and she's a big name and she's also stepped up and I think she's been a big part in Germany's success.
Okay. So that's a brilliant question, KTA. I'm just thinking now. For me, it would be, and this is purely because I'm a midfielder and I appreciate the way that the people work in this role and perhaps don't get the applauds that they should, is Henri from France. I felt had a brilliant tournament and was huge for France. And then, just because I'm still torn, I think Sasic, for me, as a nine, is just great. And, you know, Seattle, we could always do with another nine, you know, so that would be the two for me. And I'd quite happily sit and watch Henri and help her from the bench and, you know, do whatever.
Big fan of Amandine Henri. First time I saw her was back in 2011 in the UEFA Women's Champions League final when they played at Craven Cottage against Tabina Potsdam. And, yeah, for me, absolute class. Best in the world in her position. And, yeah, I can see why you've picked her. But final question, because I'm not going to get a chance to speak to you on record before the final. Who's going to win the World Cup?
I still think
Germany. Yeah.
Both going Germany?
Yeah.
Okay.
I said if France beat Germany, USA would win the World Cup. But if Germany beat France, I can't see past Germany. And they did. They did it somehow, but they did it.
Okay. Well, I think that is a nice way to end the show. Guys, thank you very much for your insight. I think it's always better coming from players rather than from me. So thank you very much for your honest answers and responses. Wish you the very best of luck for the rest of the season with the Seattle Reign. And no doubt you will be watching the World Cup final on Sunday, so maybe we'll catch up afterwards to see what your views were.
Okay, thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Women's Soccer Zone, following every kick of the World Cup in Canada.